in the process of being a little fellow who was very confused about who he was and what he was becoming and where he was going and what he would do with his life. In fact, I often say that I have yet to really decide what I want to be when I grow up. I ran across a book called The Hero with a Thousand Faces. And as you know, in that book, Mr. Campbell takes us on a most exceptional interior journey, which involves a kind of revelation, a departure from the known world, an initiation into many of the fundamental essences of life's possible meanings, and then the inevitable return to the world in a new form, almost like the butterfly emerging from the chrysalis. And that work had such an inordinate impact on me that you can imagine my astonishment when about 5 years ago I came face to face with this person that I had considered for years a major guide in my life, like a spirit guide. And so, of course, this afternoon has particularly important meaning to me in being able to share this conversation with Joseph Campbell. In way of an introduction, I think that probably a mutual friend of ours did the best job that he could possibly do in introducing you, and I can't beat that, so I'm just going to steal it.
Okay.
Bill Moyers. In an introduction, when a very great honor was being bestowed upon Professor Campbell, I said that, and I may get this a little wrong, but it'll be a fair paraphrase, that Joseph Campbell and he had been invited, you know, to the Garden of Eden to cover an important event. And they both did all of their, you know, their spade work and did a good deal of investigative journalism and so on. And then Moyer said, as it turns out, I got the facts, but Campbell got the story. So I would like to deal a little bit this afternoon with that story and in a sort of, if a sort of Campbell primer. And just ask some questions that perhaps all of us are thinking about and would love to hear some of your responses to. For instance, I mean, why do some people use the term myth, mm-hmm. as a synonym of falsity? Mm-hmm. And what really is the difference?
Let me say a word in relation to what you announced as departing from the known world,
yes.
into the unknown. That's where the whole thing gets twisted around. Here when we speak of the known world, when you speak of the known world, you mean this world that we found out about after we were born,
yes.
you know?
Yes.
And it's, of course, different from age to age, what people are going to be born into. So you spend your youth learning about that world out there. And then that becomes what you think of as the known world, whereas the real known world is your own inner world, the inner journey, of which you know nothing for some crazy reason.
Yes.
Now, the mythic forms are transformations of the so-called known world that reflect. Shakespeare speaks of art as a mirror, and it is a sort of X-ray mirror reflecting the inner journey, so that everything is changed in its aspect in order to become reflective of you in here. The whole world then becomes metaphorical, becomes a metaphor. Now, if you mistake the symbol for the reference, do you get my point?
Of course, yes.
Then you've missed the message.
Yes.
The message gets lost in the messenger.
Yes.
Now, such a motif, for example, as the ascension of avatar, a down-come deity, ascension to heaven. If that is translated into a literal fact, then all you can say is the myth is a lie. But if you realize what it's talking about the flight of the spirit from its commitment to the so-called known world to its discovery of the world out of which this known world has come, namely the world that's inside you.
Yes.
Then you begin to realize this thing is talking about something that's interesting and important to you, and it's telling you how to get there. It's interesting, my book, The Hero with a Thousand Faces, dribbled along for many, many years. I published it around 1949. And then in the 60s, when everybody was taking LSD and going on inner trips, suddenly my royalties went up 10 times. It was suddenly realized that these were not lies, but they were, they were like triptychs for the inner journey, and they had all the news of the good hotels down there, and what the meals would be like, and also the dangers.
Yes.
So suddenly this book became a record of facts that you're going to run into. But they're inside, they're not out there, and yet you can display the fact only by way of an external image. So it seems to be in the outer world, it's actually in the inner world. If you interpret it as in the outer world, it's a lie. If you read it in this other, it's a truth. Ananda K. Kumaraswamy was one of the really great readers and interpreters of mythic forms. He died, I don't know, I guess about 30 years ago. Great, great man. He speaks of myth as the penultimate truth. And my wonderful friend, whom I regard now as my ultimate teacher, Heinrich Zimmer, a great, great Indologist. I spent 12 years editing his posthumous after
Works,
he died.
Yes.
He used to say that the best things can't be told. The second best are misunderstood. The second best are references to the best, which are misunderstood because they're not understood as references to something beyond speech, but as references to facts.
Yes.
So they're misread. And to turn it into a simple grammatical statement, the connotation of the metaphor is forgotten or lost, and one reads it in terms of the denotation.
Yes. You once had a marvelous summation of this. I think, I don't know if you've written it, you mentioned it to me once, about confusing the message with the menu.
Yeah, as though you were, when you get stuck with the image and don't go past it, as I say, and some people don't like to hear it, when you're stuck with God, who ought really to be transparent to your own inwardness, but you get stuck with him out there, it's as though you would go into a restaurant, pick up the menu, and begin eating the parts of it that you thought you wanted. It's losing the message in the messenger.
Yes.
Or you're on an automobile trip and you're going to go to Boston. So you come to a sign that says Boston. Ha! Well, here we are. What a disappointment!
How does this? I mean, for two questions that I think occur to many of us is how is it? And this is an enormous question. But how is it that we've arrived in a world, our particular world,
yeah,
where we have come? I mean, most primal peoples don't seem to have this problem. Their world remains relatively transparent. Reality for them is a much larger thing than it is for us. We talk about the unconscious and so on, I mean, as if they were not valid and real parts of our lives. How did we come to a point where our society, our particular society, depends so much on the menu, on the signposts, rather than upon the essences that they represent?
You have to realize that early societies lived in a world that remained about the same for generation after generation. And even when there would take place a migration, the new environment was not so very different from the old environment. There were still trees there and rocks there and water there and the five elements, or four elements, however you like to count them, are available and all. And so these mythic forms which speak about your own inner depth, which is your nature, which is only a particle of that nature out there and is matched to the big nature world by way of the mythic imagery, it remains a constant. Do you see? And a father can tell his sons and a mother can tell her daughters things and... But my God, what I learned when I was a kid is no good now anymore at all. The environment is changing, and in our days it's changing so rapidly that people spend their whole lives coping with it. And attention is always directed to outer circumstance and no way to relate that outer circumstance to inner circumstance. The earliest people were hunting and gathering people, and all of the relationship was to their actual killing of the animals, and then a reconciliation, a psychological reconciliation with this act of violence, because the animals for those people were not just inferior things that you can kill and eat and all that kind of thing. They were actually the inspirers of their own dreams, And it was from the dream that people lived, and the very animals they were killing were the, and eating were the animals that were their instructors in life, you might say. So there's a very important ritual problem there of relating your psyche to this violence to the people. And you find that the principal food animal, particularly conspicuous in the America, in North America here, is the principal animal of worship and devotion. On the plains is the buffalo.
Yes.
And when you go to the northwest coast, it's the salmon. And the first salmon run is a period of great festivals and thanks to the animal and gratitude for his guidance of your physical as well as spiritual life. Well, we don't even get in touch with the animals that we're eating all the time. We've got people who deal with them. They come in nice little packages in the shopping area, and you don't realize when you get, you're eating a nice chop, but you don't realize what its name was.
Yeah, you know? we take it for granted that Mr. Perdue created
it. Yeah, so you
this,
don't apologize for the chop. You do this silly thing that we do. You thank God this invention of the mind, which is a metaphor of a mystery, but you thank the metaphor for giving you the privilege of eating this poor creature that is the source of your life.
Yes.
One of the terrific things about life is that it continues by way of eating and killing and eating other lives. And the problem of reconciliation to that fact is one of the big problems of mythological and ritual life.
How did we lose? You say that in our world has changed, and I assume partially what we're talking about here is in the since around the 19th century, that our value system structure has been greatly revised. Our mythology has not been revised. That interestingly enough, with Darwin and Freud and Einstein and so on, that it's rather difficult for a people's mythology to keep up with such revolutionary changes in mind. But fundamental to that, how did we lose touch with the dream? Because the dream hasn't changed.
Well, I'll tell you what I think, and I don't like to have to say it, but I think that having a scripture that dates from the first millennium B.C. and comes from a world that most of us have never even seen and can't see because it's gone now, but it's the Near East, this was brought in and impressed on a people who did not originate it. And it, furthermore, is petrified. The texts that we're reading are texts dealing with images that we have no connection with. And the world in which we live is desanctified. With the fall in Eden, nature is corrupt. Most of the primal mythologies and most of the great archaic mythologies have to do with putting you in accord with your nature, putting you in accord thereby with nature, and bringing the society itself into accord with nature. But in the first millennium B.C., there originated a mythology in which nature is rejected. The strongest statement of it is in Zoroastrianism, where you have two deities. You have the deity of light, Ahura Mazda, who created a world of light. And then there is his counter-deity, Angraminyu, who threw darkness and evil and poison into it. So that nature is mixed of good and evil, and you do not put yourself in accord with nature. But we have instruction from our saviors, Zoroaster, for example, telling us how to separate, how to distinguish good from evil. And you have the idea that there is such a thing as evil. And evil is that which somehow isn't good for you. And there's something else that is good. And so you align yourself with the good against nature. Nietzsche has a saying that I ran into a few months ago. All ideals are wicked because they devaluate the facts. Hmm. But he said, like medicine, sometimes you have to have a few ideals, you see, yes. For a while. Right. But don't hang on to them.
Yes. Emerson said, that reminds me of something, that all of nature is a metaphor of the human mind. And having just read a work of yours, and a remarkable work, The Inner Reaches of Outer Space, in which you deal with the importance of metaphor as a life, I mean, a sustaining and affirming mentality. I would love to talk a little bit about that with you because I think it's so important. Would you mind telling that marvelous story about the radio and the interviewer? Because I love this story.
Yeah, it's going to be my best story. when I published a big book for 1983, and the publisher sent me on what's called a publicity tour. This is the worst kind of tour. You're talking to media people who don't know anything about this subject. And one of the problems of a of media people is they have to look as though they knew what they were talking about, you know? And I have a whole history then of meeting these people and engaging conversations with them about my book. The first question they ask is, what are the myths? So, that's great. You're going to talk to somebody about elephants, and he's never seen an elephant. So, I devised an answer that I thought would work. Well, toward the close of this trip, I come into, I won't say what city it's in, it's not near here. And across the table is this young man. It was the so-and-so show, and this was so-and-so. And we were going to be, for 1/2 hour, live on the air. And, okay, so the red light that goes on when you're on the air was not on, and the first thing he says to me is, he says, I must warn you, he says, I'm tough. He says, I put it right to you. He says, I've studied law. So, so we go into the hour. The red light goes on. Myth. Myth is a lie, isn't it? I said, no. You shouldn't speak of just a myth. You should speak of a mythology. A mythology is an organization of symbolic images and narratives metaphorical of the possibilities of human experience and fulfillment in a given society at a given time. That was my... it's a lie. So, this impasse, you know, about 4 minutes before the end of this valuable half hour, I realized, this guy doesn't know what a metaphor is. So I said to myself, I can be tough too. I said, no, I'm telling you, it's not a lie. The images are metaphorical. Give me an example of a metaphor. So he says, you give me an example. I said, no, I'm asking the question this time. Give me an example of a metaphor. Well, he fell apart. It was a disaster. And he's squirming, saying, let's get a school teacher here or something like this. And then finally, he comes up from the floor and he says, I'll try. Well, can you beat this? We have now about 1/2 minute to go. And he says, so-and-so, and he names a name I didn't know, runs very fast. People say he runs like a deer. There's a metaphor. I said, that's not the metaphor. The metaphor is so-and-so is a deer. He says, that's a lie. I said, it's a metaphor. Then I went home. And I thought, well, for heaven's sake, half of the people are mistaking their image for the final fact. And these people we call theologians. The other half of the world knows that they're not facts, and these we call atheists. And so I stopped work on the great series of things that I was working on and wrote another book instead. This little one here, The Inner Reaches of Outer Space, Metaphor as Myth and as Religion, the theme being that when it's interpreted as myth, then you get the metaphorical relationship and you are relating to the connotation. We have a definition of mythology actually as other people's religion. And then the answer to that is religion is misunderstood mythology. And the misunderstanding consists in mistaking the metaphor for a reference to a fact. That's the law on the show.
Yes. As you speak about that, I've always been tremendously... One of the reasons that I think people in the arts are so attracted to your writing is because, in an interesting way, what you're saying also applies to another foundling of our society, quite apart from our mythic consciousness, but also our aesthetic consciousness.
It's a ruin, you know, what's happened. And these poor young artists... I've been living with artists most of my mature life. They're given the wrong instructions. They think that some kind of social message is what it's all about. That is not what it's about. Art is a revelation of the radiance of things. That's all. And how to do it is what the artist must learn. And by the way, the best instruction I know in what proper art is all about is in James Joyce's Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man. About the last third of it, you have the hero, Stephen Dedalus, discussing the nature of art. He distinguishes between what he calls proper and improper art. improper art moves you either toward or away from the object depicted. It moves you toward the object depicted with desire for the object. That he calls pornographic art. All advertising is pornographic art. And all sociological art is pornographic art because it's telling you that this is the way you want to be. And the other kind of art which repels you from the object, he calls didactic. And that is the art instructing you in what is virtuous and what is abominable. You know, let's say communism or capitalism is abominable and you're for something else. And the artist is for something else. Very much of our novel writing from the time of Zola to the present is the work of what I call didactic pornographers. They are delivering the message and putting a little juicy touch to it to keep you reading all this dry stuff. So the proper art is, as Joyce says, static. It holds you in aesthetic arrest simply with the recognition of the radiance of that thing which is there. And I could go on with this kind of thing, but it's there in the book, so you might as well read.
That, because of continuing on with this connection between mythic consciousness and the arts, it seems to me, and this is something, of course, when you were working with Finnegan's Wake, in your Skeleton Key that you did early on with a collaborator, you were already suggesting this almost when the book had first come into print. And that's the fact that, to a certain extent, that which alienates those of us in mainstream society from our own mythology, so to speak, is also that which alienates us from the vision of the artist who is attempting to make that, to get in touch with that center. Is this simply an intractable situation? Are we all, to my knowledge, we're the only society in the history of the world in which artists are alienated from the people for whom they create their work.
That happened in the 19th century.
Yes.
And what happened in the 19th century was a mass consciousness that comes in the big cities, where the civilization moves right into these big nuclei, these big cities, and all of the problems are economic, political, social. And that's where the mind is. And anybody who's not talking about solving one of these problems is uninteresting. He's an ivory towerist, an escapist, as it's called, and all this kind of thing. And I think it's a 19th century phenomenon. And the problem of the early artists, for instance, those Navajos who were doing sand paintings, it was not to solve a local problem. It was to open a window in the walls of space to eternity.
Yes.
To put your mind in some kind of relationship to that source, which is the source of all being, not to a local inner problem.
Yes.
So I think that with the enormous transformations of society that have taken place following the Industrial Revolution, really, men's concerns are so immediately economic and social, political, that they can't think of anything else. And there's nothing else to think about.
But then artists, of course, reacted to this. This is what Rousseau...
Well, then you have the bohemia.
Yes.
You see, that grows up at that time. They call them the alienated artists, but they aren't separate from society. They are part of society. They're the exploring edge of society. They're part of the society, actually. And their stuff feeds back. But I know the experience myself. I mean, having been brought up, as everybody else is brought up, in the way of these sociological determinations and so forth, to find how to break out and through that. The thing that saved me was the Depression. I came back from my student years in Europe, 1929, just about 2 weekends before the Wall Street crash. And there wasn't a job in the world. My family was destitute. And I just went up into the woods. And I gave up work on the PhD. My degrees are honorary degrees since then. That's a big joke for me. they wanted me to go to work to do the same thesis that I had started before I went for 2 years to Europe. Yes. Everything, like getting into a wet bathing suit, I had to hell with it. And I went up into the woods. And without a job for 5 years, no responsibilities to anybody, I just read and read and read and read and read. And I tell you, people were so wonderful at that time in the Depression, where everybody was knocked out and flat on his face. I had patronized a bookstore, Steckett Hafner, which no longer exists, probably for this reason, so I'm going to explain. And they were importers of foreign books. And I had gotten all tied up with a lot of German anthropologists and philosophers and so forth and so on. And I'm up there in the woods without any money, and I write down to Steckett Hafner to send me this book, that book, and another book, the whole writings of Leo Frobenius, for example.
Yes.
They didn't ask me to pay until I got a job 5 years later. That's how big people can be when they're really compassionate with the situation. So it was in that way that I worked these things out.
Right. Just to tie up the subject of art, and then I thought, was thinking it would be interesting to talk about this whole, how you came to want to see connections in a world which essentially doesn't want to see connections.
Yeah.
But ultimately, it reminds me very much of the experience that I have when I'm watching people in a museum approaching a painting. And there's a marvelous little cartoon that was published years ago in which a person is standing in front of a painting and saying, and it's an abstract expressionist painting or what have you, and he's saying, but what does it mean?
Yeah.
And in the next frame, the painting is pointing at the man saying, but what do you mean? And
that's not bad.
Yes.
That's the Buddha holding up a flower as the sermon.
Yeah. But it seems to me that the whole attitude that we currently have about art is very similar to the one that we have about cosmology, is essentially trying to see some concrete relationship between an aesthetic experience and some sort of historicity. I mean, some sort of historical basis for reality. In other words, you say, oh, I see the house in the painting, I see the tree in the painting, or what does this painting mean? It's a mystery, I have to solve it, rather than dealing with it on its own aesthetic level.